If you want to be happy at work, you should try and maintain a good work-life balance, right? Well, my next guest strongly disagrees with that. He says this is just one of the many lies that we've been telling ourselves about how to make our jobs work for us. Ashley Goodall has spent the last few decades helping companies get the most out of their employees. He's currently a Senior Vice President of Leadership and Team Intelligence at a multinational technology company in the Silicon Valley. Ashley's also the co-author of a new book called Nine Lies About Work. He's on Skype from, I think, New York. Ashley, welcome to Life Matters.
Hey, good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Tell us about work-life balance, Ashley, because I thought it was a worthy goal. Now you've just blown that out of the water for me.
Well, it's it responds to this sense that I think a lot of us have, that we need some way of sort of pushing back against the never-ending tide of work and the fact that work seems to find us in more and more places and at more and more times. So to that extent, okay, there's a good intention there, as there are behind many of the things that we talk about in the book. But when you push on it a little bit, you think, well, hang on, the presumption is that work is all bad and that life is all good, and that therefore the prescription, if you like, is that life is a little bit of sugar to help the medicine go down, the medicine being work. And you think about that for a second, you say, well, hang on, there are some things at work that lift me up. Maybe not everything, but there are some things I look forward to, some things where I feel I'm on fire, some things where I'm really in flow. And likewise, there are some things in life that actually pull me down a little bit. It's not all a bed of roses out there. So the categories aren't very helpful. And then, of course, you have the idea of balance, which is telling us to aim, if you like, for a sort of precarious state where everything's just for one second in balance. And you think, of course, well, if I ever get that balance, my only thought will be no one move, lest I lose balance again and I tip over.
A little literal. Just while you're talking about that, let me just take you to task on a few things, and I'll challenge you on this, because while you say we shouldn't think of work as bad and life as good because often they're a mixture of both, got no problem with that at all. But inherently in your dissertation on why work-life balance is a lie, isn't it inherent that you're saying we're always going to overwork? Isn't that one of the issues that we're trying to redress when it comes to balance?
That's not what we're solving for ultimately. If you look at the people who thrive in the world, what they've managed to do is to figure out, whether at work or outside work, what are the things they love doing and how to turn the needle up on those so that that constitutes more and more and more of the way they spend their time. You study people who thrive at their jobs and you find out that they change the content of those jobs over time to be more and more an expression of who they are and how they make their distinct mark in the world, if you like.
But if you're a worker with inside a company, if you're a worker with inside a company, how much room and freedom do you have to change the quality of how you do your work because you're actually working to someone else's goals?
Well, the survey data on this is actually quite clear. If you ask people how much control they have over the contents of their job, about 75% of people will agree that they have the ability to change what happens in their job and how they spend their time. Very few people do. It's what you call in psychology an attitude, behavior, and consistency problem. Right. So we feel we've got the wherewithal to do it, but something holds us back. And just to finish the thought, I think what we should all be striving for is not love work-life balance, but love-loathe imbalance, if you like. How do you build more of the things that you want into every day? And it starts by paying attention to what lifts you up at work or in life. We're often super specific about the things that drain us, about the stuff that sucks, if you like. And a little bit more careless about the things that actually invigorate us, that energize us. And it's always a good discipline to be able to go, okay, in the last week, what really energized me? And how could I offer that more? How could I spend more time doing those things? It's a pretty good prescription, I think.
Do you think that kind of way of approaching work works across all kinds of workplaces? I'm thinking even when it involves hard labor, repetitive work.
It happens wherever you find a differing experience in people doing the same job. So, you know, one of the earliest studies was a study of hotel housekeepers. And you would think that, you know, there's a pretty solid formula for that. You go into the room, you vacuum the room, you clean the towels, you make the bed, you vacuum yourself out of the room again. But in fact, if you study hotel housekeepers, you find that some are really, really good at it, and some are much less good. And the ones who are really, really good at it find love in the way that they go about it. So I would say in any role where you can find a range in human performance, you're likely to also find a range in the human emotional experience of that work, which means that we all have room to flex, if you like.
Let's talk about productivity, because you say some of the lies that you've written about in this book center around the idea that all bosses, all companies are trying to lift productivity. But hasn't your research indicated that productivity, if you look at hours per capita, hasn't really lifted since the 1970s?
Yeah, productivity is flatlined, essentially, if you look at the data, as has, by the way, global levels of engagement at work. Those two things haven't budged very much, certainly for the last 20 years. And so I think the argument of the book is what we're trying to do isn't working.
For example, and feedback and appraisal. This is one of the cornerstones, as I know from the ABC and other corporations like us and many companies around the world, where you're given at least an annual sort of talk back time where you can say, here's what you're doing right, here's what you're doing wrong. You're saying that kind of feedback is just counterproductive.
Well, it doesn't build excellence. Again, when you look at the world through the lens of how do you help humans do better at work, you look at the science on that, you look at the evidence, you are drawn to some very different conclusions. So saying to somebody once a year anything, firstly, isn't very useful because work changes by the day, certainly by the week. And so humans thrive under the condition of attention to what they're doing, where they need attention. And if your attention mechanism is an annual one, it's not doing anything to help, with apologies to the folks at ABC over there. And then the second thing is the sort of feedback that helps us grow, because of the way the brain is wired. Brains build on what's already there and what's already working. So the sort of feedback that helps us grow draws our attention to the stuff we did well and invites us to build on it. Now, this is, again, another flip. We're used to thinking of good job as the end of a conversation, right? You've done something really well. I say, good job. We go about our lives. Good job is the beginning of a conversation if you want to be in the excellence business, because what follows it is good job. What were you thinking then? How did you reach that conclusion? Have you ever done that before? How did you figure out how to do that? A whole bunch of interrogation to help you understand what patterns in my brain was I using and how could I use them more?
This goes to the heart too of leadership, doesn't it, within companies and how leaders behave when it comes to encouraging the best from their workers. You argue, in fact, that, at the moment, so much of our lives, particularly in the developed world, is geared towards reaching our full potential. What's wrong with that?
Well, again, it depends. It sort of depends what you mean by potential. If you mean every human being reaching the fullest expression of what they have to offer in the world, amen to that, thumbs up. If you mean, on the other hand, the practice that many, many companies have of going through every year and sorting people into those that have potential and those that don't, then that's an act that flies in the face of everything we know about human development, because all human brains can grow. They just grow in different ways and in different directions. And also flies in the face of, you know, the oft-pronounced phrase from companies that our people are our most important asset, our people are our most critical asset. Mm. If they were, we wouldn't start by discarding half of them and saying, well, you're essentially, you have no chance of growing or developing in any way, so we're going to ignore you.
So this comes to one of the great sort of central tenets of your book. You argue, in fact, that there's a great forgotten element that keeps people functioning at the best of their abilities, and that is they do it when they're together.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we talk about work and we talk about how to improve the world of work, if you like, how to raise engagement, how to raise productivity, we talk on two different levels. We talk about corporate culture overall. We talk about the company as though it's one big monolithic entity. Or we talk about individuals. We say we've got to help Michael or we've got to help ABC, but nothing in between. if you actually look at where performance varies inside an organization, and also where people find support and expression of who they are, the answer is always a team. It's always a team of people. And the reason for that is that teams, firstly, can at their best see you for who you are. They understand your quirks, if you like. They understand where you're weirdly brilliant. They understand what you run towards, what you run away from. And they can then harness that and fuse that, if you like, so that a bunch of people with different strengths, with great diversity, can contribute their strengths in the proportion, if you like, to which they're needed to get something done that no one could do by themselves. So when you look at our experience of work every day, it's actually more the people around us, our team, than the company we belong to. If you look at where we can get our best work done, it's when we're surrounded by people who see us and value us for who we are and support us.
Do you have a concrete case example, actually, where there's been a change in workplace culture that actually recognises the glorious complexity of a team and its ability to work together and all its warts and all and flaws that has turned around maybe productivity, maybe a company's morale? Do you have any case example of that?
Well, the place I work, Cisco, part of my job has been to help us move in this direction. And over the last several years, we've deployed technology that allows every team leader to see the strengths of everybody on the team, to measure the engagement of the team in real time, to pay attention to each team member on a weekly basis, according to what the team member says, I need attention to this, this, and this, here's where I need your help. So we've rolled that out in the last couple of years, certainly. And the results that we're seeing, engagement in the company overall is increasing, so we can see that happening. And if you get the anecdotal evidence by talking to people, they will tell you that the effort on teams, A, makes sense to them because there's an inherent truth. Yeah, I know this is my experience of work. And B, that they're very pleased to see it paying dividends for us.
I mean, if nothing else, as a company, you want people to retain staff because they're happy where they are and they're getting creatively challenged and feeling like they're collaborating, because that means you don't have to spend, potentially millions of dollars re-employing or deploying or finding new people. So even at that level, you would think there's some real strengths there. But one of the things that sort of really struck me about your approach in the book on this, Ashley, is that you're asking leaders to have a totally different mindset and skill set than perhaps they have at the moment.
In terms of organization leaders or team leaders?
Both, actually. Both organizational leaders handing down that kind of sense of purpose and structure to a team leader.
Yeah, so again, at the moment, I think organizational leaders are focused it's a broad statement, but on control. On how can I control people? How can I control what's going on? And once an organization gets to any size in today's world, that's a practical impossibility anyway. And the systems that we design to create control actually end up creating friction in an organization and I think annoying people who are on the receiving end very often. So we argue that the job of a senior leader is to cascade purpose through the organization. And that's not a one and done deal. That's an every day, every week, every month thing. You've always got to be talking about and exemplifying and signaling why we are doing this work together, what values we should honor in doing it. Then at the team level, the job of a team leader is really two things. See everybody for who they are, understand who they are as an individual, make the team a home for their weirdness, if you like. And then communicate to everybody a sense of a common future. A universal future in which we support one another, in which we have a clear standard and a clear understanding of what excellence means to us. Any team leader who can master those two things will be doing a pretty good job.
Yes, well, we can only wait and hope. Ashley, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Ashley Goodall on Skype there from America. He spent the last few decades helping companies get the most out of their employees. He is the co-author of a new book called 9 Lies About Work, and we'll put some details up on the RN Life Matters website.
Hi, I'm Lisa Leong. If you enjoyed hearing that story about work and would like to find out more about how we can work better, then catch my show, This Working Life, Tuesdays at 11:30 a.m. or on podcast.